Good evening and welcome to a new class series on this Dogen fascicle called Shobogenzo Hosho Dharma Nature, the Nature of Things. This is our year at the Zen Center of studying and practicing the middle way. So we could say that all of the Buddha's teachings and all of Dogen's teachings are actually about the middle way, but when looking through all the possibilities for this year, this particular fascicle of Dogen leaped out of the pages to my mind and eyes, and I felt like this is a nice exposition of the middle way by Dogen, and it's kind of short and sweet. And I think studying Dharma and, you know, these traditional texts like this, studying sutras and studying Dogen, is hopefully applies to our daily life and practice, and something that we can actually use. It kind of maybe shifts our understanding of practice a little bit and refines our understanding. And it's also just becoming familiar with these, we could say, like our family style, particularly studying Dogen. Dogen's very unusual. I think maybe everybody here has looked at Dogen some. He's kind of difficult. And I think that's part of the beauty of studying in a group, because we can kind of slowly go through and unpack the strange language of Dogen and see the beauty underlying it and the points that he's trying to make. And becoming familiar with that kind of language. You know, sutras have their own kind of language too, so we study those some also. And then when we hear like more modern commentaries or presentations of Dharma, we can see how they're grounded and rooted in these classical texts of the Buddha and the Zen ancestors and Dogen. So I hope we enjoy this study. I always like the challenge and wonder of studying Dogen. So this fascicle was written in 1243, which was like a super prolific time for Dogen. He wrote a large part of the Shobogenzo in this year. He had just left Kyoto, where his first temple was, moved to the mountains of Echizen, where a Heiji was being built. So this is kind of the construction period. And maybe that's why he had time to write all these things, is because they weren't really like fully practicing in the whole monastery setup. They were building and living in this small buildings at the foot of the mountain. And Dogen was writing a lot in 1243. And this is called Hosho, which means Dharma nature. Ho means Dharma, and the Chinese character that they chose to translate the Sanskrit term Dharma means like law. Law is a kind of literal translation. And principle, something like that. The law or principle of things. It's made up of the character is made up of water on one side and going or moving. So it's kind of like the way water goes. The principle behind things is the law. Sometimes some in English translations, they still say the Buddha, the law, and the Sangha. Buddha and Sangha, they came up with new characters to translate that only mean Buddha and Sangha. But it's for some reason, instead of just coming up with a new one for Dharma, they used this character they already had in Chinese that means something like law or principle or way of doing things. And nature is the usual translation of this term show. Nature or quality could also mean purity, can also mean gender. And that's made up of, the Chinese character is made up of one half is heart or mind, and the other half is birth or life. So it might say like the heart of life, or the essence of life is its nature. The nature is like the essence of the life of something. Maybe we could say that. You know, etymology in English and Chinese doesn't always match up exactly with these characters, but that connotation is in there. So Dharma nature, it's the same show as Bu show, Buddha nature. And this is one way of translating the Sanskrit term dharmata, hosho. Dharma nature is a translation of dharmata. So maybe we don't use that term so much. Dharmata is like the nature of dharmas. In this case, dharma you may have heard, besides meaning like the Buddha's teaching, means phenomena. Dharma is like this amazingly dynamic term in Sanskrit, but one of the common meanings is things or phenomena. All dharmas are marked by emptiness, we say. That doesn't mean all teachings are marked by emptiness. It means all things or phenomena. Experienceable phenomena. Sometimes in English we write like dharma with a small d, and for phenomena, and dharma with a big D for like the Buddha's law or teachings. There's no big and small in Sanskrit. It's a dynamic term. You never know exactly what the connotation is except in context. But in this case, I understand it as it's the nature of phenomena. Thomas Cleary translates this hosho as the nature of things. And this is a classical term, particularly in Mahayana, Indian Buddhism, dharmata, as opposed to dharma. It's the nature of dharmas. Or in English, you know, we have the suffix ness, like emptiness. So, you know, empty is shunya, and emptiness is shunyata. It's the same ta here. Dharma and dharmata, shunya and shunyata. So emptiness, or we could say the nature of the empty is what emptiness is. So it's like nature of something, the ness, dharma-ness. We might be able to say dharma-ness or thingness. There's things and then there's the thingness of them. That doesn't quite work in English so well, but that's a little bit more of that. Of what this ta is. Another word that's somewhat familiar to us is ta-ta-ta. You ever heard ta-ta-ta? It means suchness. So ta-ta means such, like the ta-ta-gata is the such, or the thus come one. Ta-ta-gata, the thus come one. But if you just add the ta to the ta-ta, you have ta-ta-ta, that's thus-ness, or such-ness. And in this case, dharma-ta and ta-ta-ta are basically synonyms. The nature of phenomena is thus-ness. The nature of phenomena is the nature of thus. And one of the classic, maybe as far as I know, one of the most well-known Indian treatises, you know, fully bringing out the meaning of Dharmata, Hosho, is a text by Asanga. Asanga is the 4th century founder of Yogacara school, and his, as legend goes, Asanga met Maitreya Buddha in some kind of samadhi. He went to Tushita heaven without leaving his zafu, and received this amazing amount of like teachings from Maitreya Buddha. So some texts by Asanga are attributed to Asanga himself, like he wrote them. He claimed, "I wrote this." And some he said, "I didn't write this. I'm just channeling Maitreya Buddha." So there's particularly these 5 treatises that are attributed to Maitreya as recorded by Asanga. And there's this one called Dharmata Vibhaga. Vibhaga is like distinguishing or explicating Dharma and Dharmata. Dharmata Vibhaga is distinguishing the difference and similarity between dharmas and dharmata. Or we might say distinguishing things and the nature of things. We have several English translations, but this is a nice one that this translator calls Maitreya's distinguishing phenomena and pure being. That's like a loose translation, but brings out some of the meaning. Pure being is another translation for dharmata. So we could call this essay Shobogenzo, Pure Being, according to this translator. Dharma and dharmata, distinguishing them. So just this is a little bit of background, because I think Dogen knew about these terms. He titled his essay after this term, dharmata. So this is a little bit from Asanga. Asanga is an important text on distinguishing dharma and dharmata. Basically, he sets up these definitions. The definition of dharma, dharmas, which we usually translate as phenomena or things, he says, it's that which is classified here as phenomena or dharmas is samsara. That which is classified precisely as dharmata, or the nature of things, or pure being, is nirvana, transcendence of suffering. As this is defined by all the vehicles of Buddha Dharma. So that's his first statement, is that phenomena or things is the realm of samsara. And you know, samsara is like the cycle of birth and death and suffering, where there's separate phenomena. That's what we're talking about here, is phenomena or dharmas are all the multiplicity of all these things. The way the world appears as a bunch of stuff is the realm of samsara. And dharmata, the nature of things, is the realm of nirvana, or freedom from suffering. And so this is classic early Buddhism. This is two kind of opposites, in a way, is samsara is the cycle of suffering. We're being driven around and around by our habitual patterns and delusory thoughts. And nirvana is like the liberation from this samsara. So in early Buddhism, it's like the problem and the solution, in a way.
Are you saying the essence of samsara is nirvana?
Well, that's what's going to come. Yeah. That's what Asanga is going to say. But in the early teachings, in like the Pali Canon, it's not said that way. Mm. It's just presented like, here's the problem, we're caught up in this in this samsaric cycle, and we have to realize nirvana. But that's exactly what's going to happen in the Mahayana story, is that the essence of samsara, the nature, the very nature, the true nature of samsara is nirvana. So that's now we're getting into the non-duality of the Mahayana teachings. And like Nagarjuna brought this out. He might have been the first to really bring this out. It might be in the Prajnaparamita Sutras, definitely implied in the sutras. But that actually, when we look for nirvana, it's not something apart from samsara. It's not like some like escape. You eliminate phenomena and then you have, or you obliterate them somehow, and then you have this transcendent nirvana that's like, you know, something completely different. How could that be? the Mahayana meditators started investigating. Therefore, we see that the very nature of samsara, of the very nature of all our like grasping and problematic habitual suffering patterns, the very nature of that, when we settle completely into it, is actually this freedom of nirvana. And yet, so they're not exactly the same, right? It's more like there's samsara, and then there's the nature of samsara is nirvana. Or there's phenomena, and the true nature of phenomena is dharmata. So they're not, they can't be separated actually, but they're not exactly the same either. So Asanga, or Maitreya, defines them like this. First he says, dharmas is samsara, and dharmata, the nature of phenomena, is nirvana, transcendence, going beyond suffering. As this is defined by the Shravakas, the Pratyeka Buddhas, and Bodhisattva vehicles. And then he sets out the definition of dharmata. A little more about dharma before we go to dharmata from Asanga. He says, here the traits of dharmas, or phenomena, are defined as duality of perceived and perceiver. So this is the world of phenomena. Phenomena are based on the duality of perceived objects and the perceiver. Like, they're separate. In a way, that's what phenomena are, right? They're like, there seem to be like separate existences apart from our mind perceiving them. That's what we call phenomena. External things that the mind or that I as a person relate to. That's the very definition of phenomena, is the duality of perceiver and perceived, plus the assumption that such an appearance actually exists in that way. So part of phenomena is this assumption that that's really how things are. They're really like separate from the mind. They're really dualistically apart from the perceiver. And the mistaken conceptual process that projects this duality of perceiver and perceived. Since what appears, the object, is not truly existent and is thus not actually real and separate from the mind in the way that it appears. No reference of the terms used, like, say, book, no referent, an external referent of the term book, has actually ever existed and being but an imputation on the part of one's conceptual thinking consists solely of conceptualization. So this is a kind of wordy Indian way of talking about basically the world of phenomena is just a conceptualization. Our mind creates the multiplicity of things when we say, this is a book as opposed to a cushion. It's not really like actually that way, as Sangha is proposing, but that's the way our dualistic minds are set up. They make distinctions between different phenomena, and that all phenomena are distinct from the mind perceiving them. So that's laying out the definitions of dharmas or phenomena. The other factor, dharmata, or the nature of things, is defined as suchness, or ta-ta-ta. The object of intimate, self-aware wisdom, in which there's no differentiation between the perceived factor and the perceiver, a signifier and a signified. So we're the signifier. We put signs on things, and the signified are the things that we put. Signs are like names connected with the, you know, referent of things. So like book. So as we've heard, you know, language is very big part of constructing this dualistic world. We do it through words, and we definitely, and the words solidify it, and then we really believe that this is a book. This is a book, right? You know, that's just like some, that's a referent, it's a word connected with this referent that we all agree on, and then we actually think that it is a book. But book is just this word, and the words and language tend to like reinforce the illusion of separateness. So I heard, all heard this kind of thing before, but this is how it's being set up here by Asanga. And it's a whole book that he gets more and more detailed about distinguishing phenomena and the nature of phenomena. But actually, there's I don't want to go into too much of this, but one other piece here from his, as the introduction where he's setting this up, is this is important, I think. These two, dharmas and dharmata, are not one and the same, nor do they differ. Because between that which exists and that which does not, now we're talking about that which exists is suchness, is the non-duality of perceiver and perceived, we could say truly exists in the way Asanga is setting it up. And that which doesn't exist is the separation between perceiver and perceived. So that which exists, suchness, and that which does not, the illusion of separate phenomena, a distinction exists conventionally and yet does not exist truly, because if one did exist, its counterpart would... If one of them did not exist, its counterpart would not exist either. Right? You can't have dharmas without dharmata. You can't have dharmata without dharmas. You can't have phenomena without their nature, and you can't have the nature of phenomena, obviously, without phenomena. Right? So they can't be separated. The mere lack of existence of phenomena cannot be separate from phenomena. There is no existence of an actual essence constituting them as separate. So I say, well, this seems like samsara and nirvana, dharmas and dharmata really are separate, and we really have to, eliminate one and realize the other. But there's no actual substantial anything that actually separates them. That would be another projection. So they're not, we can't say they're exactly the same, but we can't say that they're separate either, dharmas and dharmata. So that subtle and dynamic relationship between phenomena and their nature is what Asanga writes this whole book about. And actually, I think what Dogen is writing this essay about too. And much of Dogen's writing is about this dynamic of, it's not exactly like there's these things over there separate from me and the multiplicity of everything, and it's not exactly like, well, there's nothing at all, or just some kind of suchness apart from things. So with that background about dharmata, now here's Dogen's celebration of dharmata, the nature of things. Hosho. He says, when you study Buddha Dharma with a sutra or with a teacher, you come to realization without a teacher. Coming to realization without a teacher occurs due to Dharma nature. So we study Buddha Dharma, and study means learning in the way we usually think of study, but also just Zen practice is studying Buddha Dharma, right? Zazen. And our daily life of awareness, all of this is studying Buddha Dharma. We do this with a sutra or with a teacher, and this is brought up in other places through Dogen too, kind of like two different approaches to understanding Buddha Dharma. The sutras are the Buddha's teachings that even though Zen is the separate transmission outside the sutras, as it said, still we need to understand what the practice is. And as Dogen goes on here, it becomes clear that it seems that what he's saying is if you just, like in a vacuum, if somebody didn't know any of the Buddha's teachings and just said, just go sit. Go sit in the corner for like several years, and if you just do that, you'll completely understand the Buddha Dharma, and you'll realize the way and of this freedom from suffering. I think Dogen's saying, maybe that's impossible. You might get very relaxed and you might discover various things. Sometimes we say, Zazen is our teacher. We do learn many things, but without any teachings about how things are, it's such an unusual view, I think, Buddha's and Dogen's teaching, that we might not discover it on our own. I mean, there were many, many centuries, right, of meditators sitting silently in a yogic posture, letting go of their thoughts before Buddha came on the scene, right? And it seemed like they may be similar, but they maybe didn't realize exactly what Buddha realized. So there was the wheel of Dharma of the Buddha was set in motion, and then it's a specific kind of understanding, you could say. So, and we study Buddha Dharma with the sutras, and now we could also say all the Dharma teachings after the Buddha too, the Zen teachings and so on. And teacher, you could here it's the translation of Kalyana Mitra, which means a good friend. Which you could say is just the practical thing of somebody like teaching a class or something about how things work, but I think there's a difference between a sutra and a living person, too, right? It's a living person's a relational thing. So it's more how do we apply the sutra teachings in our actual life, and that's where the great gift of practicing with a living good friend is so beneficial. But interestingly here, Dogen says, you study Buddha Dharma with a sutra or with a teacher, but you come to realization, and that's the character for Satori, means realization, without a teacher. So almost implying we maybe even need to study sutras and with teachers, but our actual realization is without a teacher. Coming to realization without a teacher occurs due to Dharma nature, or the nature of things. So it's not like the sutra can actually give you some understanding, or a teacher can give you some understanding, really. It's that the nature of things is actually what brings forth the realization. And it's very similar also to Buddha nature. Hosho is similar to Busho. And I haven't heard this myself, but when I think of, well, is there some difference between those? Why even have two different terms? I think they're very similar, but my understanding of the difference between those is that Buddha nature, I see more as like the nature of mind. The way that mind cannot be grasped, and the way that this very mind is Buddha, and Buddha means awake, right? It has a kind of cognitive, mind-oriented aspect, right? The nature of awakeness. So, at least traditionally in India, they would say a rock doesn't have Buddha nature. Later in Zen, they start, we're not going to let that one go. We're going to just examine that too. But just the way when Buddha nature was first brought up as an understanding in India, it was like sentient beings with minds. The nature of their being or their mind is Buddha nature. Whereas Dharma, phenomena, are not aware or sentient, and yet their nature is emptiness or suchness also. So I see Buddha nature is more like the subject, the suchness of the subject or the mind, and Dharma nature is like the suchness of phenomena. We just heard, as the Sangha says, well, there's not really a difference between the mind and objects, and yet, conventionally speaking, we can talk about mind and objects and the nature of mind being Buddha nature and the nature of objects being Dharma nature. That's how I would understand it. Very similar, but Dogen has another fascicle called Buddha Nature, and it does have actually more of that, a little more of the mind flavor, I think. So realization comes without a teacher due to the nature of things, the way things are. Even if you have knowledge by birth, you should always look for a teacher and inquire about the way. So this knowledge by birth is... as some of the commentaries say, it's maybe actually a Confucian term too, but I think Dogen's using it as something like Buddha nature. Actually, that's how I hear it. Now we're talking about knowledge again. The way knowing, kind of an innate knowing of how things are. I would say not necessarily like conceptual knowing or being able to name this is a book and this is a cushion, because we don't have that at birth. But there's a kind of knowing at birth that we and all sentient beings share. If there is a knowing at birth before there's any names or signs, then I would understand that as like Buddha nature. There's an awareness that actually experiences the world from birth, right? And actually, even it's the you could say even we're born with this awake, clear nature at birth too. That's how I understand his use of this term, knowing at birth. It's like a true awakeness that's our birthright. Even if you have this knowing by birth, you should still always look for a teacher and inquire about the way. Because we all have this knowing by birth, but we still have all these illusions and suffering due to misunderstanding of the nature of things. So that's why even if Buddha nature is our true being from birth, we still need to find the sutras and inquire teachers and inquire into the way. Even if you have beyond knowledge by birth, you should always practice in the endeavor of the way. So this is where Dogen starts to get dynamic and difficult to translate. Beyond knowledge by birth is this, in the Chinese characters, is like no birth knowledge. So this Kaz Ta-Nehisi translates as beyond knowledge by birth, because knowledge by birth is just birth knowing, birth knowledge, birth knowing. And now we're talking about no birth knowing. Mu shou qi. So he translates it as beyond knowledge by birth. But another Thomas Cleary's translation is knowledge of the birthless. Pretty different. Knowledge of the birthless. Birth knowledge. And maybe this is actually part of what Dogen's trying to do. Dogen likes doing these word plays. So I think it might actually be there in the Japanese that it's ambiguous. You could translate it either way, because he's using this term, birth knowledge, but then there's another term in Zen, no birth, or the birthless, the unborn. This is actually the way you write the unborn, which is this, you know, important Zen term, is no birth. And then you have this, here we have the little knowledge on the end. I don't know if you can follow this, but the way that the Chinese is set up, you could say it's beyond knowledge by birth, or you could say it's knowing the unborn. And maybe Dogen meant it to be this, like, he's playing with this, with these words here. So Kaz says even if you have beyond knowledge by birth, you should always practice in the endeavor of the way. You could say, even if there's something deeper or beyond this knowing by birth, even if you say, well, if we really have something even beyond that, then maybe we don't have to practice. Like maybe Shakyamuni Buddha had something even more than knowing at birth. So if it's beyond that, he says, even if it's beyond that, you still have to practice. Because Dogen's emphasis on always have to practice. But we could also hear it as, even if you have knowledge of the unborn, even if you know the unborn, like emptiness, you should still always practice in the endeavor of the way. Kufu bendo. Kufu is Japanese for kung fu. And kung fu is like we usually think of martial arts, but literally it means like effortful activity. Any kind of effortful activity. So Dogen actually uses often that combination, kufu bendo, the kung fu, the effortful activity of wholehearted engagement in the way. Bendo, bendo wa is the writing on the wholehearted way, endeavor of the way. Who does not have knowledge by birth, and yet study a sutra and follow a teacher? Because everyone actually has this Buddha nature by birth. And yet, actually in the text it says, and yet up to the fruit of Buddhahood, Bodhi, study a sutra and follow a teacher. Know that to encounter a sutra or a teacher and experience Dharma nature samadhi is called the knowledge by birth of Dharma nature samadhi by encountering Dharma nature samadhi. Dharma nature samadhi, or like Thomas Cleary's translation, he likes it creatively retranslate. He says, absorption in the nature of things. It's Dharma nature samadhi. Samadhi, we could call, say absorption, one-pointedness, total presence, and there's many kinds of samadhi that Dogen brings up. Dogen has a fascicle called Jisho Zamai, so the self-realization samadhi. The ocean seal samadhi, the samadhi of samadhis, these are all different fascicles of Dogen, and self-receiving its function samadhi, the Jidyu Zamai. So many samadhis taught in Mahayana sutras and by Dogen, and we could examine what's the difference between them. I think in general, we might see that actually these are all the same. These samadhis with all these different names are actually the same. Total awareness with no reification of subject and object. But for the sake of poetry and writing a lot of different essays, they have all these different names. So here it's the Dharmata Samadhi, the absorption in the nature of things. And it might be that, I don't know if that's in the sutras, but Matsu, our Zen ancestor Matsu, talked about this Dharma Nature Samadhi, which is maybe where Dogen gets it from. And it's going to show up later in the essay. So now it's almost like we're talking about the nature of things. Now it's like a kind of a practice with the nature of things, which is absorption in the nature of things, total presence in the midst of what's happening without any sense of separation. And as we're going to hear later in this essay, this is not just like, facing the wall on a cushion. This is like our daily life. Is this absorption in the nature of things, this Dharma nature samadhi. Matsu will later say, all sentient beings have never left this Dharma nature samadhi. This is like a big statement. We're all in it all the time. So this is, the beauty of Zen, right, is all beings have never left absorption in the nature of things. Wearing clothes and eating food and everything, all the senses and their experience is always the nature of things. So, which is quite in accord with Asanga and Maitreya saying, where there's this phenomena that's just these dualistic appearances that aren't really real, but that's not separate from the nature of these phenomena, which is like reality. You can't really escape reality, according to Mahayana Buddha Dharma. And yet, then how do we appreciate that? Maybe before going on anymore, any questions so far? Could you follow all that about the relationship of Dharma and Dharmata? Not exactly the same, and yet they can't be separated either.
I keep hearing like practice realization.
That's another, yeah. In a way, I think like so many different terms and ways that the Zen teaching especially gets presented is like these two sides that are that seem to be separate but aren't really. So practice and realization is one of them. Practice and realization can't be separate, but you could say the realization is beyond any like activity. Is another activities are another dharma, and yet practice is like an activity, and yet they can't be separate. Yeah. And of course, form and emptiness. Form does not differ from emptiness. The merging of difference and unity, all of these relationships between these seemingly opposites not really being opposite is the same dynamic here as dharmas and dharmata.
Is there a difference between what you're saying about practice realization? Or is it subtle? Or?
I think practice and realization is... I hear more like talking about the experience of a practitioner, right? That practice is an experience and realization is an experience, we could say. Whereas dharma and dharmata is not so much about an experience, but more about how things are. You know, whether or not we experience it. You could say, well, the point of bringing it up is because we're talking about experience and how the experience of dharmas, according to Asanga, is called samsara, and it's painful. Experience of dharmata is nirvana, and it's freedom from pain. So it's related to experience, and yet it's more like maybe more ontological, which is like just talking about how things exist as either dharmas or dharmata, whereas practice and realization may be more like epistemological, which is like more like how we know or experience things, but closely related. And then you could say that's why there's these different terms. And I think it's even if we say like, well, form and emptiness is maybe the same thing as dharma and dharmata, still, to use these different terms helps, for me, I feel like it helps the mind become more flexible. We don't I don't want some new terms, let's just work with form and emptiness. Well, let's just use some different words, and they may be are different entrances into this relationship. Especially dharma and dharmata, I think it's a really nice one because the words are almost the same. Right? I think that's the beauty of that particular relationship. Dharmas and dharmata, so similar. It's just a little ta is the difference between heaven and earth.
What I like about that too is the dharmata being the nature of things, suchness has got a kind of quality of acceptance of things as they are, whereas just dharma, you can like or dislike all the stuff. I like just the flavor of the acceptance of the nature of things, quality just to the sound.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually.
Sort of somatic side.
Yeah, it's almost impossible in the world of things to not get into like and dislike, actually. Mm-hmm. Whereas the nature of things actually can't be liked.
Exactly.
Or disliked. Yeah.
You can't really dislike the nature of water. The waterliness.
Yeah. And if we think we do, like I really like the nature of things. That's like so great. If we say, well, we've actually made it into a dharma again. And if it's something we could like or dislike, we made it into a phenomena. I like emptiness more than form. What kind of emptiness is that?
My name is Wilma, and you've probably forgotten.
Yes, I haven't seen you for a long time.
I went to the Mount Madonna retreat that Rev gave, I guess, last weekend.
Oh, nice.
Or so. And he talked about exactly this. He had a Dharma Ka on this whiteboard, and on this easel, he had Dharma.
He actually used those words?
He had, it was about sickness, old age, and death. No sickness, no old age, no death. And then what do we do about this? Then there's the teaching of suchness and the practice of suchness. And you've given us the teaching of suchness pretty clearly to me anyway. The practice of suchness, as I understood Rav to say, is welcoming this thing that you don't like, illness, sickness, death, whatever it is, your own fears or whatever, pain in your back, welcoming it in and examining it. The welcoming and making friends with it, or just say, come on in, is part of it. And but the examining, what is this? Constantly saying, what is this? What is this?
Exactly,
and
yeah.
Eventually, knowing that you can never expect an answer.
Because
you still keep asking, what is this?
Yeah, if you get an answer, then dharmata becomes a dharma.
Yeah. But what that does, he described it as a gap between these two. Between the suchness and the phenomenon. And this was a way to narrow the gap, actually.
By inviting.
To study the phenomenon very intimately and lovingly, and keep on asking, what is this? And it brought these two things close enough together that you might have a sense that there is no distinction.
Yes, that's beautiful. That because they can't be separated, therefore to think, well, let's just have the dharmata and forget about the dharmas, it won't work, right?
Yeah.
So by studying the dharmas, the phenomena, really, really carefully, then we see their nature.
Mm-hmm.
Their nature is right there with them. It's not some other place. So if we're looking some other place for their nature, we'll always miss it.
This is where it is.
Yeah. And yet, it's not exactly the thing itself. It's its nature. So, by studying it...
Well, by the time I have said something about it, it doesn't touch it.
Yeah.
I've created another dharma.
It's a little bit reminds me of... The metaphor doesn't quite work exactly, but I think of those 3D images, these books that where there's like... It's like a picture that you just see on the surface, but however it's created by a computer or something, beneath the picture that you see, there's another 3D image, right? Y'all know these?
Yeah.
These books? They're
Magic Eye.
Magic Eye, yeah. They were popular for a while. Maybe they've kind of like, people got tired of them. But I think it's a nice metaphor for practice is you're looking for this 3D image, but you're looking right at the surface image that's really obvious, and if you look at it too intently, like you're staring at it, it doesn't work. You're making too much effort, you can't see the image behind it. But if you keep looking at it, don't veer away, and yet at the same time, in a very relaxed way, very relaxed, letting your vision relax. And then, for me, it actually took like a very long time. Some people could just look at these and get them right away. Like, and the longer it takes, the more frustrating it is. Can't get it! So then you make more effort and it's not going to work. Relax. And then at some point, maybe just about to give up. There it is. And then maybe even get a little bit excited and look a little harder to try to solidify it, and it's gone. Okay, just relax again. And there's this...
The other thing I remember him saying was, why did I lose it? Don't touch it and don't turn away.
Yes.
Don't grasp it and don't try to run away from.
Yeah.
Don't cling to it.
Very similar, yeah.
This is that you're
thinking about. Looking too intently into dharmas, is kind of grasping, and then looking some other place is turning away. Which is a line from the jewel mirror samadhi that we chant in the Zendo. Turning away and touching are both wrong, for it's like a massive fire. Just to depict it in literary form is to stain it with defilement. So this, you could say, suchness, it's like a massive fire. So if you touch it, then you'll be burned, and if you turn away, you'll just get cold. So it's a nice image too. Now again, this is the middle way. That's a nice verse for the middle way. I think, did Jean even bring that up in the last talk? Somehow we caught recently hearing in the Zendo something about turning away and touching are both wrong. It's like a massive, the middle way is like a massive fire. If we try to grasp things, we get burned. And if we try to turn away from things to find some emptiness apart from things, we miss it. Thank you. And as we study these things, you know, sometimes it seems like it can sound abstract, right? and yet, the more we can like tune into like this is all talking about what's happening right now, always, right? So that I think the idea when studying a sutra or talking with a teacher or practicing Dharma nature samadhi is it's always about what's happening right now. Again, it would be like say like, well, after class I'll think about this some more and see how it might apply or something. Anyway, that's like kind of turning away. It's more like this is it, and any moment of our life actually is like there's this dynamic relationship between phenomena really existing the way they appear, which is it's never going to work out that round, and versus like if I could just check out of this human realm, then everything would be okay. I don't know if you ever go there. I can like start thinking that way sometimes, and, like that's like turning away. It's like right in the midst, and I think that's what this essay, as it goes on, is about, and Matsu brings this up too. So this encountering a sutra or a teacher and experiencing Dharma nature samadhi is called the knowledge of birth of Dharma nature samadhi by encountering Dharma nature samadhi. Almost like this absorption in the nature of things is actually gives rise to all experiences itself. This is acquiring knowledge of a past life, acquiring the three miraculous powers, and realizing unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. So, I think just emphasizing that that the Buddhas, you know, in this tradition, it's like Shakyamuni Buddha's great enlightenment is like kind of like the be-all and end-all. It's like if you're a serious practitioner, we say that's like the ultimate. Shakyamuni Buddha's great awakening, you know, is beyond compare. So this Dharma nature samadhi stuff might be kind of nice, but it's not like Shakyamuni Buddha's great enlightenment, right? So Dogen, I think, saying here, this is what we're talking about. This is the knowledge of past lives, the three miraculous powers, and realizing unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. The three miraculous powers is vidya, in the Buddha's life story, on the eve of his great awakening under the Bodhi tree, he had these three knowledges in the three watches of the night. Maybe you heard the story. First he had this vision of all his past lives, going back like infinitely, in great detail. I mean, this is in the Pali Canon. I was had such and such a name. I ate such and such food. I wore such and such clothes. In such and such a family, and maybe all instantly. Ken and I just went this weekend up to UCSC. They had the Brain, Mind, and Consciousness Society, which is a student club that had their annual conference, a bunch of different speakers, and really great stuff, and it's all kind of related to, I think, Zen practice without using that term. And one of the speakers, Raymond Moody, talked about near-death experience. Mm-hmm. He's actually the one who coined the term near-death experience in like the 50s or something. He's been doing this for so long. And anyway, that's one of the common things. He's just basically thousands of interviews with all these people who've had these near-death experiences and how universal they are. And then he draws no conclusions, just like a good Zen practitioner. I'll be studying for my whole life, but I still don't have any answers. But one of the things that I think is interesting is that very common when these people basically are like clinically dead, but then they're somehow revived, and they have this review of their whole life. They say, like, your whole life flashes before your eyes. It's very common, and they describe it. It's not just like a linear step-by-step thing. It all happens maybe instantly, but it's very clear and in great detail of, like, all the events of their life. And also, he said, the particularities of the relationships with other people, and particularly in terms of like harmful things one has done and the pain is caused and feeling the pain, and helpful things, kind things, and the joy that's come from that for the other person and oneself, kind of identifying with both. So I thought, and also, of course, this sense of complete like oneness with everything and no separation. So I thought, these three things in his story, I thought, these are very much like these three knowledges on the night of Buddha's enlightenment, where the Buddha saw all his past lives. In this near-death experience, it's usually not like a bunch of other lives. It's just like, maybe the Buddha went deeper than a past life, than a near-death experience, right? To see all these past ones. The Buddha's second knowledge was like the workings of karma and cause and effect, and kind of seeing everybody else's lives going way back, and particularly how like good always leads to good and harm always leads to pain, or good always leads to happiness and peace, and harm, and how karma, you know, in terms of harmful and non-harmful, actually creates this pleasant and unpleasant, and moving up and down through samsaric life. He said that was one of his visions in this really broad way. And then the third was what we think of as the Buddha's enlightenment. The most important one, you could say, is knowledge of the cessation of outflows. That's how the sutras put it. Basically, the end of suffering and ignorance, and the realization of the Four Noble Truths, apart from any formulations, but like deeply understanding in the most experiential and complete way what suffering is and what the cessation of suffering is. Sometimes it's said the first two are almost like shamanic kind of states that were maybe important to the Buddha's later teaching about more conventional things like karma and rebirth, and then the actual content of the cessation of suffering. very similar to near-death experience. Anyway, this is what's happening here. Dogen saying this Dharma nature samadhi is acquiring knowledge of past lives, acquiring these three miraculous powers, or these three knowledges of the Buddha on the night of his enlightenment, and realizing perfect enlightenment. All that fancy stuff in the Buddhist tradition is simply absorption in the nature of things. That's part of the Zen style, is bringing like this very amazing, refined, seemingly impossible states and so on down into the very like ordinary, because we're all always in the nature of things. So you encounter knowledge by birth and study knowledge by birth. You encounter knowledge without a teacher and spontaneous knowledge, and authentically transmit knowledge without a teacher and spontaneous knowledge. I think it's more of the same here, is that encountering knowledge by birth is like encountering your Buddha nature, and studying that is like investigating what's happening. And this knowledge by birth is knowledge without a teacher. And you, through this absorption in the nature of things, you authentically transmit knowledge without a teacher and spontaneous knowledge. Dogen likes to use that term, shoden, the authentic transmission of the lineage of Buddhism ancestors, which is basically what we think of as like a very personal thing. It's a teacher-to-teacher thing. So it's playing with this a little bit, because this authentic transmission of teacher-to-teacher is without a teacher. Without having knowledge by birth, you cannot hear Dharma nature, and you cannot realize Dharma nature, even if you encounter a sutra or a teacher. So, luckily, we all have knowledge by birth. You can't avoid that. But if we didn't, like if we didn't have Buddha nature, we could read all the sutras and encounter all the teachers. We could possibly gather together, and we couldn't realize Dharma nature. So I think this whole section so far is talking about the relationship of our, you might say, inherent true nature. That's our birthright, that's already completely present, completely complete, lacking nothing. We need that part, and then we need to access it. It's like we need the key to access it. And then so that's the encountering sutras and teachers part. And it's like both of them are necessary, and neither one on its own would work to course in the absorption in the nature of things. Without having knowledge by birth, you cannot hear Dharma nature, and you cannot realize Dharma nature even if you encounter a sutra or a teacher. The great way is not like someone who drinks water and therefore knows whether it's cold or warm. It's interesting because this is one of the, I don't know who came up with that phrase, but it's in the Zen teachings. It's sometimes like realization is like knowing for yourself whether the water's hot or cold. Like you can't explain it to somebody else. If you've never felt hot or cold, you can't say, well, it's like this sort of prickly feeling or something. Huh? It's like, or this water, you know, it's like a direct experience it's talking about. You taste it and only you know whether it's hot or cold. And it's beyond description. How do you describe hot or cold? But yet, it's a very direct and a nice example too, because very simple and straightforward experience too. Just drinking water and knowing whether it's hot or cold, I think is a nice image that that is what realization is like. But here, it's the opposite. The great way is not like someone who drinks water and therefore knows whether it's cold or warm. What do you think about that? Any ideas?
Well, I was wondering, it seems like there's a personal interpretation of all this. You have knowledge by birth, etc. But if you think instead that it's intrinsic in our just being, you know, it's part of the firmament that actualizing, and then that's the knowledge that's intrinsic or that's acquired by birth.
Yes.
It's actually part of our being.
Yeah. And what's that? How does that relate to the hot or cold part?
I'm sorry?
How does that relate to the knowing whether water is hot or cold?
That's something that we acquire by symbolic knowledge, I think.
Manipulating
the concept of hot.
Uh-huh. We could say hot and cold are phenomena, are dharmas.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Knowing whether it's hot or cold. So this this dharma nature doesn't have characteristics like hot and cold. Yeah. So this is like when Dogen starts talking about realization, it's just maddeningly subtle, because it's almost like if there's any way you can describe it or get a hold of it or say this is different from before. Then you're like making distinctions and conceptual separations, right? And yet, then that's kind of like the touching side. And then turning away side, it might be a little bit like, well, then this is always it. And so we can't say anything about it at all. So then, like, why practice? Or what's this big deal about realization then? It's sort of like turning away, you know, just forget it then. So, yeah, I think this is the beauty and genius of Dogen, is that he keeps pushing us to investigate, and yet any hold on anything we can possibly get, he'll pull it away again. Can we stand? Keep going.
Snatch that pebble. Do you ever snatch a pebble out of his hand?
Like, yeah.
Kung Fu.
Yeah. No, it can't get. Yeah, I can't get anything. And yet, in the very listening and the wholehearted engagement with investigating the words of Dogen and these ancestors. Maybe we have some sense and we start to like open more to our sense of things becomes a little more like loose and flexible, maybe, just by the investigation.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes have that sense, yeah. We might say, oh yeah, that's it, and then that's not it, right? But yet, it's interesting to sometimes In a kind of grasping way, I could say at the times when I'm fully engaged in like studying Dogen and really trying to hear him, what he's saying, it does feel like experience is more open. And if I'm like, no, I'm just involved in the day-to-day practicalities, we feel like our life feels like diminished or smaller. One of the speakers at this conference at UCSC is talking about the vertical and horizontal kind of like aspects of life and experience, and that the horizontals, like the practical, do you remember these terms that he used?
Yeah, the vertical and the
but what were the two?
Well, there's like moving on, move, you know,
yeah.
Like your way of living, you know, I get up, I go to work, I get this, you know, and then vertical is more of a, like, spiritual practice, mindfulness, but there's also like the dreams and...
Yeah, like I think he equated the muscle with active and receptive.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, so the horizontals, the active, get up in the morning, we're already late, go to the next thing, do the next thing. And I was like, practical. And then go to sleep and get up and do it again. He gave a great. And anxiety expressing depiction of life like this. And you do it. He was like running around the stage, screaming almost. And then you die. If you're just in the horizontal like that, that's like, what a life is that? And then the vertical is like, yeah, the spiritual just being and the receptive non-doing, not about practical, but just about like presence.
There was a negative aspect too. It's like, I forget the talking part, but you know, it wasn't spirituality. There was something like maybe like enlightenment or something, but the bottom was psychosis.
Uh huh. Yeah.
So there was good and bad.
Dreams and then nightmares
and
shadow side, yeah. Psychosis, yeah. Mm-hmm. So all of that, and it's about the meeting. It's like you can't just, it's not, we don't just live in the vertical, and we maybe do often just live in the horizontal, but actually we need the ideal
meeting is
that we're doing our tasks, and I think this is what this essay is about too. We're wearing clothes and eating food. And doing our daily life within the flow of the vertical receptive presence at the same time. Yeah.
I have a question about the past lives. Mm-hmm. Since we have no way of knowing, investigating, right, whether there are past lives or future lives, why is it there? Why is it in the...
Well, I guess we could say in the Buddha's, as the sutras have come down to us, the Buddha's description, because that was his experience. And we could say, well, maybe they weren't really his past lives, right? We could say it was just a hallucination. Some might say that, right? And same with other people who, since the Buddha, like this, various people investigate these people's memories of past lives. And it's impossible to know. Was that really a connection? Were those lives really connected in some way to this present life that's experiencing them or not? We can't really prove it. And yet, you could say it's there in the sutras because the Buddha had that experience and he seemed to feel that it was connected. And it kind of, I would say, it's in accord with his teaching of dependent arising, is that everything's connected, actually. Everything arises in dependence on something else from the past. So that was kind of one aspect of his, one implication of his teaching of dependent arising that he seemed to have on that night. So you could say, it's in there. But it's a big topic because this teaching of rebirth was already around before the Buddha's time. Mm-hmm. So we could say it was just a cultural thing. You say, well, no one knows what happens after we die, but that's the main cultural understanding in India already. So that's not contradictory to my teaching, the Buddha might have said, and people are always going to ask. So let's use that one. We could say it. Maybe our modern view, we might say, oh, he's just being practical, or we might say that on some really deep level. And we've heard of other people since the Buddha who are like through meditation and so on. Seem to confirm this, but we don't know. We don't know. And this Raymond Moody in this conference, that was the one thing that, you know, he's like, I don't think he has any particular religion himself, actually. He's just like, I'm just doing all these interviews. But another common thing that in these near-death experiences is people seem to contact close relatives and friends that have died in their life, not exactly see them maybe, but in some way that they feel like they really know that it's them. And I thought, that's the one piece of his, all his interviews that didn't exactly accord with the classical Buddhist view of rebirth. All the other stuff actually was like, yeah, this all fits in with the Buddhist story, but that piece didn't, because those people wouldn't be hanging around 10 years later. They're like in some new life. So we still could say it could these stories could be in accord, because it could be like the way that you're meeting those beings from your life is like, it's more like you're meeting your relationship to them. It's part of your life, and some other, you know, part of them is reborn in some other realm, but there's still, it's like the lingering traces of their relationship to you that you're meeting. This is my story. But yeah, I could say it's maybe not the most important thing, because we don't know what happens after this life.
I think the top line was the horizontal was logos, I think, and the top was mythos, isn't it?
Oh, that was another way of putting it. Yeah.
Being alive. It was like the vertical was like the aspects of being alive, whereas the horizontal was kind of like this time machine that we had to keep doing things, and we're going somewhere, we're going to leave, we're heading somewhere.
And logos is a word, the conceptual, right. Conceptual language,
yeah.
Which is what Asanga is talking about too here.
Yeah.
Mythos is like almost like non-conceptual.
Yeah.
So, that'd be enough for tonight. The great way is not like someone who drinks water and therefore knows whether it's cold or warm. Maybe also a little bit like Dogen is not so fond of the Zen term Kensho. Rinzai Zen, I mean, this comes from the sixth ancestor of Zen, so it's part of the heritage of all schools of Zen. Seeing nature. It's the same show as Hosho, right? Seeing nature, it's abbreviated for seeing Buddha nature or seeing Dharma nature, and both. And Rinzai Zen tends to emphasize the term more, like, you see. It's like, seeing kind of implies as kind of a subject object, not necessarily, but a little. But you could say, I think that this is why Dogen almost never used that term, and I think even like critiques it in one of his essays. He uses other terms for awakening, like practice and realization, or not to practice and confirmation or verification. And I think it's because it's the seeing. I'm seeing the true nature of things. It kind of implies, the very word seeing implies somebody seeing something. And maybe that's a little bit like this phrase of tasting water and knowing whether it's hot or cold. A bit like Kensho. You know it's like this, and it's not like this. Whereas the way is not a matter of knowing or not knowing. Thanks for your attention and courage to study the difficult writings of Dogen. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.